Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, December 17th, 2025, we are delighted to host this Courthouse Steps preview program on Trump v. Barbara. My name is Matthew Sawtell, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief. If you would like to know more about our speakers, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Mr. Trent McOtter, Professor Michael Ramsey, and Professor Elon Werman as our speakers, and Professor Randy Barnett as our moderator. Professor Barnett is the Patrick Ho Tung Professor of Constitutional Law at the Georgetown University Law Center and is the Faculty Director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Professor Barnett, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Matt, and thanks, Matt, for having me. Get right into this because we've got a lot to talk about here. On June 27th, 2025, a class action lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of New Hampshire challenging President Trump's Executive Order Number 14160, which denies birthright citizenship to children born after February 19th, 2025, to parents who are either illegally present in or temporary residents of the United States. On July 10th, the district court issued a preliminary injunction barring the execution of the order. And in September, the Trump administration petitioned the Supreme Court for a writ of certiorari before judgment. The court granted cert and will hear oral argument in early 2026. In this case, the court will decide whether Executive Order 14160, quote, complies in its face, on its face, with the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment and with 8 U.S.C. Section 1401A, which codifies that clause, unquote. Thus, determining whether temporary or illegal residents of the United States are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and therefore entitled to the birthright citizenship. That's what the court will be deciding. Now, before this became a live issue, I had tried to keep up with this subject, but I was always frustrated by the debate. I found it was there was a combat or an exchange of sources being cited by either side, and it was very difficult for me to figure out who was right and which sources were the most pertinent. I just was kind of lost. Until I started thinking about it more seriously, and in the interest of full disclosure, Elon Werman and I had a op-ed in the New York Times earlier this year. And as I thought about it, as I've been thinking about it, it turns out there's an awful lot of agreement. And I think it's very useful to focus on the principles that everyone in this debate, or at least all the scholars in the debate, agree on. This is not true of everybody on X, I should say, but it is true of everybody who I think has written about this topic. And then that allows us to focus all of our attention on the disagreement, of which there's a considerable one. So let me just start off by saying that the 14th Amendment's birthright citizen, so-called birthright citizenship clause, because it doesn't say birthright citizenship per se. What it says is that birth in the United States is not enough. There are two requirements of citizenship under the 14th Amendment. The first is birth within the physical area of the United States. And the second is when for persons who are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. There's general agreement, I think, about that, and there has to be. And there's general agreement that the issue here is the meaning of subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And if you're an originalist, the debate is over the original meaning of the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Okay, another area of agreement is that there were three classes of persons who were thought at the time of the 14th Amendment not to be subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And these classes were diplomats, Native Americans who are part of tribes and invading armies. So that's an agreement. There's also agreement that the citizenship of children born in the United States follows from their status of their parents, I mean, were their parents diplomats, Native Americans, or invading members of invading armies. And finally, most agree, I wouldn't say everybody necessarily does, but I'll say most agree that these three classes do not constitute a closed set of three and only three classes that are thought or that are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, but that that language, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, is invokes a more general concept under which these three classes fall, but potentially other classes might fall as well, which brings us to the debate now. And that is, do children who are born to parents who have entered the country unlawfully fall within these classes? Do their parents fall within these classes? Let me say that again. Do persons who have entered the United States unlawfully fall into under the subject of the jurisdiction of the United States? And also, do temporary persons who are passing through, transients, aliens who are passing through lawfully, do they fall under this conception? And that's what this debate is about. And to help us with this debate, we have three outstanding speakers, two of whom I know have written extensively on this topic. I'm not sure about Trent, but let me just briefly introduce our three speakers, giving them a very short introduction so that we can spend more time on hearing them speak. We first start off with Professor Mike Ramsey, the Warren Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of San Diego School of Law, where he teaches and writes in areas of constitutional law, foreign relations law, and international law, a very widely respected originalist scholar. Second, we have Professor Ilan Werman, the Julius E. Davis Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches administrative law and constitutional law. He writes primarily on the 14th Amendment, administrative law, separation of powers, and constitutionalism. And as I already mentioned, he and I had an op-ed on the birthright citizenship question in the New York Times earlier this year. Finally, we are joined by Trent McCotter, a partner with Boyd & Gray, PLLC. He previously served as Deputy Associate AG of the United States and as an assistant U.S. attorney. So with that introduction, I turn it over to Mike. Our speakers will speak in that order. And I'll turn it first over to Mike Ramsey to give us his take on the meaning of the 14th Amendment. Mike.
Well, thank you very much, Randy. And thanks to the Federal Society for putting this together and inviting me here. I agree with everything that you said we agree on. And I agree that the question on the table is what is the original meaning of subject to jurisdiction in the citizenship clause. So I'm going to make four quick points. The first is that the clear meaning of jurisdiction is subject to authority or under the authority, under the lawmaking authority, under the rulemaking authority, under the power of a sovereign entity. So if you think about a court, you're subject to a court's jurisdiction. If the court has the authority to order you to do something or to not do something, to pay money or to give up property, whatever it is that court may order you to do, if you're not subject to the jurisdiction, it means you're outside of the authority of the court. The citizenship clause is talking about the jurisdiction of a nation, but the idea is parallel. A nation has authority to order you to do things, to use its law enforcement power against you. If you're under its jurisdiction. And if you're not under its jurisdiction, then it does not. And that's just the dictionary definition of jurisdiction. It's the dictionary definition that they used at the time of the drafting of the amendment from the 1865 edition of Webster's Dictionary. If you look it up there, that's just what jurisdiction means. And just on that plain meaning, it seems clear to me that the categories of people that we're talking about here are subject to jurisdiction because they're under the lawmaking and law enforcement authority of the United States. And conversely, the categories that were outside of that, that they clearly understood to be outside of jurisdiction, diplomats and so forth, or outside of that authority because they have international law immunity from the jurisdiction of the sovereign. So second point, this is all consistent with international law. International law of the 19th century had this idea of the jurisdiction of a nation, and it was the idea of sovereign authority. And the sovereign authority was primarily territorial, And the sovereign had authority over everything and everyone within its territory, subject to some narrow exceptions, the most prominent narrow exception being for diplomats. And if you look at a 19th century writing, this is the idea that they had, that diplomats were not subject to the jurisdiction of the sovereign in which in whose territory they served. So this is in international law writing, Henry Wheaton, who was the leading international law writer, leading American international law writer of the time, lays this out quite clearly. And you can also see it in Chief Justice Marshall's opinion in the Schooner Exchange, where he talks about who is and who is not. He uses the phrase amenable to jurisdiction, but clearly means the same thing. And he finds that diplomats are not amenable to jurisdiction of the sovereign. But others are, including specifically temporary visitors. Third point, it makes sense that the drafters of the 14th Amendment adopted this jurisdiction requirement for citizenship, because what it does is aligns with the English common law, going back at least to Blackstone, indeed further than that, that under English law, you were a subject of England if you were born in the English territory, even though your parents were aliens. And this was a general rule that applied to more or less everyone, except for people with international law type immunities, like diplomats and invading armies, but not other children of aliens. And this idea of the English common law carried over into the United States. And then that you can see that that's what they're adopting when they put that language into the 14th Amendment. This also relates to the idea of the Native American tribes, because the Native American tribes were outside of the jurisdiction of the United States, because by treaty or just by practice, the United States didn't assert authority over the internal affairs of the tribes. The tribes were treated as quasi-independent nations, who had their own lawmaking and law enforcement power within the tribe. And for that reason, the drafters, and there's an extended discussion in the drafting debates about this, that for the drafters understood that their language about jurisdiction didn't cover the tribes, because the tribes were not subject to this kind of authority of the United States. And then final point, the idea that there is a quite broad meaning of subject to jurisdiction and therefore quite broad meaning of citizenship is confirmed by the drafting debates, where they specifically talked about the question of the citizenship of the children of Chinese immigrants who were principally living in California at the time. This issue was raised and debated and objected to by some people, that the clause would give these people, that is the children of the Chinese immigrants, U.S. citizenship. And nobody doubted that it did have that effect. They just debated about whether it would be a good idea or not. But the significance, I think, there is that they generally assumed and understood that it would broadly give citizenship to the children of Chinese immigrants, without trying to figure out whether the Chinese immigrants were legal or illegal, whether they were temporary or permanent residents. But instead, they just chalked as not distinct set of categories of immigrants, but just generally about immigrants. And I think that shows that they were thinking of a very broad view of subject jurisdiction and therefore citizenship, with the exclusion of diplomats, invading armies, and other people who might have some kind of international law immunity. So in sum, I think the original meaning is quite clear. It means that you are a citizen if you or your parents are under the authority under the lawmaking authority and the law execution authority of the United States at the time that you're born. And so that excludes diplomats and other similarly situated people, but it does not exclude the children of temporary visitors or people who are not lawfully present.
Great. Randy, you're on mute, but
yeah,
I assume.
I want to thank Mike. Yeah, I thought I'd thank Mike for that very concise statement of a complex issue. There's much evidence. That's the problem with originalism, is that you have to deal with lots and lots of evidence. And now I turn it over to Ilan to do a comparable brief summary of a contrary view. Take it away.
Am I sorry? I didn't want to hear the opposing view, so I just struck him down.
Yeah. I guess this is where he was warning us before that we have a, he's got a possible internet problem there. So he's frozen, right? Trent, this is taking you out of order. You're an experienced litigator. You're used to having surprises thrown at you and being able to respond well. And so take it away.
Thanks, Professor. I appreciate it. So I'm a partner at Boyd & Gray. Our law firm has submitted an amicus brief throughout most of the Birthright cases in the district court when we could find local counsel, and then up at the circuit courts and at the Supreme Court, both at the preliminary stage and now also at the cert stage and eventually at the merits stage. Our brief covers a dozen different issues. There are a couple that I wanted to focus on as ones that I'm particularly interested in to see whether the party's full-blown merits briefs and the justices' questions really home in on these issues or not. Maybe I'm thinking they're more interesting than they actually are. So the first one would be whether the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment has the same scope as the 1866 Civil Rights Act. So for those who don't know, which is probably most people, the 1866 Civil Rights Act confers citizenship on those, quote, born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power. So obviously the framers, the members of Congress, didn't stop with the statute. They went ahead and did a constitutional amendment as well. And you might think from that, well, obviously they wanted the constitutional amendment to do something different. I think actually the background shows that's not the case. I think they probably meant to do the same thing because there were real questions about whether they had constitutional authority to enact the 1866 Civil Rights Act. In fact, even some of the Republicans who voted for it said afterwards, we're not sure we have authority to have done that. And President Johnson kept vetoing it. Eventually, they overrode his veto. So they decided to do the 14th Amendment. The thing, of course, even setting that aside, is the 14th Amendment does not use the exact same language. Instead of saying not subject to any foreign power, it says the person must be subject to the jurisdiction thereof of the United States. That is, one is stated negatively, not subject to foreign power. The other stated affirmatively is subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Our brief argues that at the time, those two concepts really meant the same thing. And the reason for that is because someone could be subject to the jurisdiction of a nation, only one nation at a time. And if you wanted to switch from one to another, you had to renounce the former one. Dual citizenship, it was something that was present, but was very rare. It was viewed suspiciously. And so that was something where it kind of confirmed that if you were subject to a foreign power, you could not be subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. When the 14th Amendment refers to subject to the jurisdiction, it's really just saying not subject to any foreign power. Indeed, I think in 1884, in Elk v. Wilkins, the Supreme Court had a decision that I think supports that view. It says that the 14th Amendment version says that subject to the jurisdiction means completely subject to the United States' political jurisdiction and owing direct and immediate allegiance. And if you're still allegiant to another country, it's hard to see how you can be completely and directly allegiant to the United States. There can't be another country in the mix. And so I think, yes, obviously they use different terminology. I think that the view at the time was these two things mean the same because it wasn't really possible to be loyal or allegiant to two countries at the same time. So under that view, how would it play out to the subjects that we're talking about here, children of aliens illegally present? Well, most of them are still citizens. The parents are still citizens of their home country, their country of origin. Most of those countries claim children of their nationals as nationals themselves. For example, Venezuela would say if two Venezuelans come to the United States, they have a kid in the United States, that child is a Venezuelan national. So under that view, then under the 1866 CRA, you'd say, well, the children are subject to a foreign power. They don't get citizenship. And if you think that the 14th Amendment adopts the same view, then it would be the same answer. So that's one issue. Now, of course, in the interest of fairness, I'll say that the Supreme Court's Wong Kim Ark decision, I think, undercuts that view, at least to some degree. Remember, for those who don't know, anyway, in that case, There were parents who were Chinese citizens. They were the equivalent of LPR, so lawfully present permanently in the United States. They had a child born in the United States. There's indication that the Emperor of China would have claimed that child as a Chinese citizen. So under the view that I just espoused, and under the 1866 Civil Rights Act, I think it's pretty clear that child would not be entitled to 14th Amendment citizenship. Of course, the Supreme Court said the opposite. They said he was. And I think you can argue first that the court was just wrong about that. They kind of contradicted their decision from Elk just about 10, 15 years earlier that said it's one country or the other. You can't have affiliation with two at the same time. Or you could say that Wong Kilmark was really turning on the fact that the parents were here legally and permanently. And I think both of those are critical because the logic of the court's decision is they're here with the United States' permission, but also because they intend to stay here permanently, they have effectively abandoned any prior affiliation with their country of origin. And if that's the case, they're not really subject to a foreign power anymore. They're not subject to China anymore. They are subject only to the United States. So I think, again, it'll be interesting to see how much the 1866 Act comes up. I know that Wong Kilmark is obviously a heavy issue in the case. Everyone's talking about that. But if you think that the Civil Rights Act defines the 14th Amendment and that the meaning carried through, then it suggests that Wong Kilmark is kind of a narrow exception rather than the general rule about how to think of birthright citizenship. So there's another issue, which is one that Professor Barnett had mentioned, which are the three exceptions here. And I think he's right. Those are the three that pretty much everyone agrees on. Children of foreign ambassadors, foreign military personnel, and American Indians. I would actually say I've seen in some of the decisions below an indication, at least from the judges, and I assume the plaintiffs as well, if I check the briefs, that they think those actually are the only three, that there aren't any other exceptions. And I get to come up with a rule that covers just those three, but nobody else. Like, is there a through line for those three? So think of kind of the immunity argument that I think Professor Ramsey is hinting at least. And even for foreign diplomats, they typically don't have complete immunity. At the very least, it's contingent on their home country asserting it. But even if we assume that they do have complete immunity, foreign soldiers certainly do not. You look at like ex parte querum, maybe, for example, there. And American Indians certainly do not have any kind of immunity that's unique to them. So it can't be immunity. And if we think about some of the other kind of differences between them, like American Indians have a relationship with the United States. There are laws from the very first Congress where Congress is regulating American Indians. Professor Barnett will correct me, but as far as I know, there probably aren't many statutes where the United States is regulating things going on in Mexico for Mexican citizens at the time. And so it is a little odd to say that American Indians have kind of a less direct relationship with the United States, less subject to its jurisdiction than individuals who are born in another country, citizens of another country, and have come here without lawful permission. So I think there's also a little bit of a logic there. I think also Professor Barnett said most people agree that we look to the parent status at least as a relevant fact. And I think it's right. People do say that, but then some people kind of say the opposite. So when you point out these examples, children of ambassadors, children of soldiers, I'll say, well, this is proving we're looking at the parent status, right? There aren't any children ambassadors. There aren't typically, you know, children upon birth are not soldiers either. But when you say that, when you say we should look at the parent status, they respond and say, no, 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 you don't look at the parent status. The parents in the modern context are the aliens who came here unlawfully. You have to separate that from the children. The children were born here, born in the United States, and by being born here, they become subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And so I point that out just to say, I'm very interested to see whether the parties, whether the court first tries to come up with a through line for these three exceptions. Is it that there is a rule, or is it more that each one is kind of sui generis and we have an explanation for them, but no one else? And also, do we kind of admit that by admitting those three and acknowledging those three categories, that we do in fact look to the parent status? Now, it may not be this positive, but it is certainly relevant. And I'll just say a lot of the briefing and decisions below, that's something that the plaintiffs in these cases oppose very strongly, that you should consider the parent status. They want to focus just on the child and say that the child, by virtue of being born here, is subject to the jurisdiction, which is circular, right? Because there are two requirements, being born here and being subject to jurisdiction. But they really strongly try to move the argument away from the status of the parents. There's a dozen other arguments, like I said, I could get into that our brief covers, and I'd be interested. But those are two in particular that I think are not getting quite as much attention, but I'm personally very interested in them.
Thanks. I don't know how much of that Ilan was able to listen to when he got eliminated, but let me just say one thing about who I think is agreeing and who is disagreeing. I think those who have written about this matter in a scholarly way, or maybe even a brief writing way, but agree on the positions that I say there's agreement about. It's clear on X, but also with respect to advocates in court, they don't all agree on that. I do think, however, that agreement and then the area of disagreement is going to be what structures the argument, which is what we're here to try to preview for the audience, what to listen for when we get to oral argument. And it's going to be, I think, with those areas are going to be stipulated to of agreement, and then we'll be focusing on subject to the jurisdiction thereof. I'll say one more thing about this before I turn it over to Ilan, and that is that it's very important, I think, when considering any part of the Constitution, especially the 14th Amendment, to take the whole phrase into account, the original meaning of the phrase, not just of the individual words that make up the phrase. And so what we're looking for is the meaning of subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And that's more like it's like due process of law, equal protection of the laws. And you have to have all the words in there in order to figure out what they mean. Okay, Professor Werman is back with us from Icy, Minnesota. Go ahead, take it away, Ilan.
Thank you. And first, I want to apologize. I'm not in Icy, Minnesota, precisely because it's so icy. I am in rural Arizona for December, and the internet's a little spotty here, and I can't guarantee it won't go out, but I think I had it fixed. So again, I really apologize for that. And Trent, thank you for jumping in. I think my agreement, I'll focus on the common law, I think, a bit more than Professor Ramsey did, but then connect it to jurisdiction. I think our disagreement is one of emphasis and application, but that may make all the difference in this case. So I'm also going to focus, I should say, on those here illegally rather than temporary visitors. Maybe if we have time, I'll also talk about that in another round. So let me start with the common law and the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom was that birth on soil alone was sufficient to confer birthright citizenship. I don't think that's so some people do recognize the status of the parents, but not everybody, right? So Keith Whittington, for example, Randy, in his paper, partly responsive to mine and others, says that the status of the parent actually is irrelevant. That birth alone, that's the title of his piece, of the child is what counts. And so the question of common law is, how do you explain the exceptions for ambassadors and invading armies, right? And so Keith and says a common law that, well, they were in service to a foreign ambassador. But that's not what the sources say. So when you look at Sir Edward Cook in Calvin's case, invading armies aren't on foreign soil. Cook says in that case that although the child born is born on the king's soil, the child is not a birthright subject. Why? Because not born under the ligience of a subject and under the protection of the king. So in fact, so the test wasn't birth alone. At common law, the test was birth alone and under the protection of the king, and more precisely, birth to parents who were under the protection of the king. And this goes to Randy's initial introduction, because that's what when Cook says born under the ligience of a subject, he means you have to be born to a subject. Now, a subject could be a temporary, an alien who's temporarily become a subject of the king by exchanging allegiance and protection. But the point is, the test was under the protection of the sovereign, and specifically to parents, being born on the king's soil to parents under the sovereign's protection is how Cook describes the exception or why the rule doesn't apply to invaders. It's what Blackstone says, why ambassadors and their children don't count, because the child is born in the allegiance, which is the counterpart to protection, of another sovereign represented by the father, the ambassador. So again, parental status is what matters, and whether they are under the protection and therefore within the allegiance of the sovereign. So that's the actual rule. Justice Story in the famous English case explains it as follows, and this one I will quote: "Nothing is better settled at the common law than the doctrine that the children, even of aliens born in a country, while the parents are resident there under the protection of the government, are subjects by birth. So the bottom line is, ambassadors and invaders aren't exceptions. They're simply outside the scope of the rule itself, which again is being born on the sovereign soil to parents under the sovereign's protection. Okay, so how would this have applied to unlawfully present aliens? And I say would have applied because, as you'll see, the law generally allowed aliens to come and engage in trade and so on. Well, it turns out that from the Middle Ages onto the 11th, 12th, 13th century, to come into the realm of England required a grant of a formal legal document from the king called a safe conduct. And this safe conduct not only granted the king granted the king's permission to come into the realm, but extended the king's protection while in the realm. So there are numerous examples in my paper. You can go look at them. One from 1157 said some merchants would be under the king's custody and protection while in the realm. Similarly, a letter issued to two French knights, they'll be under our protection, our being the royal we. There are lots and lots of these examples. Here's Blackstone summarizing grants of safe conduct in his commentaries. Quote, during the continuance of any safe conduct, either express or implied, the foreigner is under the protection of the king and the law. So in other words, it seems to me to be under the king's protection, which was part of the test for birthright subjectship at common law, required the king's permission to enter. Now, eventually, safe conducts fell into mostly disuse, but not entirely, because the statutes opened up trade and allowed foreigners to come into the realm. And these statutes specifically extended the king's protection in doing so. So Magna Carta allows aliens from friendly countries to have safe and secure conduct, that is protection, unless they had been previously or publicly forbidden. The Carta Mercatoria a few years later was a grant of protection and safe conduct generally to merchants from various European countries. Here's my favorite example, because it's so clear. A 1353 statute from the reign of Edward III said as follows, quote, merchant strangers may safely and surely under our protection and safe conduct come and dwell in our said realm. So this is why Sir Edward Cook and William Blackstone presumed correctly that alien aliens who came in amity, their children were birthright subjects, because under the statutes that were then existing, aliens from friendly countries were allowed by the statutes to enter the realm, which statutes specifically extended to them protection. Now, what about enemy aliens? It turns out that for them, safe conducts were still relevant, and that even an enemy alien, and I'm not talking about like a soldier in an invading army, I'm talking about a subject from a country that happens to be at war with you. So think British subjects in America who were here before the outbreak of the War of 1812. Well, two cases emerged out of the War of 1812 involving these enemy aliens. And the question was, in one of them, could he sue on his contract? Could he sue in our courts to enforce his contracts? Because the plaintiff claimed that they didn't have to make good on the contract with the British subject because he was under the law of nations, an enemy alien, and who couldn't sue on his contract. And here's what Chancellor Kent, James Kent, said, quote, a lawful residence implies protection and a capacity to sue and be sued. So here again, we see the connection between lawful residence and protection of the sovereign and connection to jurisdiction, which I'll end very briefly on in a moment. In another case of Charles Lockington, he had an order of exclusion from the coastline, but didn't much like it in Reading, Pennsylvania. So he went back to Philadelphia and hoped nobody would find him, but he was discovered and arrested and imprisoned, and he sought a writ of habeas corpus. And here's what the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, quote, he has no municipal rights to expect from us. We gave him no invitation and promised him no protection. So it seems to me that a common law birthright subjectship only applied if your parents were under the protection of the sovereign, and if your parents had come unlawfully without invitation, without permission, without a safe conduct, they would not have been under the protection of the sovereign. Now, what does all this have to do with jurisdiction? Sort of the final short point. I think Professor Ramsey and I agree that by subject to the jurisdiction, they meant the complete jurisdiction of the United States, legislative, executive, judicial. They said this in the legislative debates. It's the only explanation for why the Indian tribes were excluded, because they were subject to some degree to our jurisdiction, including criminal jurisdiction in the General Crimes Act of 1817, and then certainly the Major Crimes Act of 1885, which came after. But again, no one seemed to think that that made them subject to the jurisdiction in the relevant sense. So in what sense might unlawfully present aliens not be subject to this complete jurisdiction? Well, go back to that War of 1812 case from Chancellor Kent. He said a lawful residence implies protection and a capacity to sue and be sued. In other words, can you criminally prosecute someone who's here without invitation? Sure, but does it mean you have to allow them access to your courts, to allow them the benefits of the civil jurisdiction, of the civil law, and to be able to sue on their contracts in our court system? So it seems to me when the founder said subject to the jurisdiction and they meant the complete jurisdiction, that doesn't just mean subject to physical authority and the physical commands of the sovereign. It's, do you get to access the benefits of the sovereign's jurisdiction, the sovereign's courts, and the sovereign's civil law? And I think if the answer is that is part of being subject to the jurisdiction, then arguably unlawfully present aliens are not subject to that complete jurisdiction. I have a little bit more to say, but I disappeared. And before I disappear again, I'll just stop there and save it for another round. Thank you.
Great. That was admirably concise. You got a lot in. Mike, there's a lot on the plate there for you to respond to. You got two against one at this point. And so you should take the time you need to respond to both Trent and to Alon.
Well, thanks. And I'll try to keep it brief because I do want to hear from our audience if they have questions. But to Alon, I think that much of what Alon said may or may not be true with the common law, but it's gotten us very far away from the jurisdiction, which is the language of the amendment. And I think that's what we want to keep focused on, is whether someone is subject to the jurisdiction. And so I don't, you know, whatever the intricacies of the English common law were, I think the bottom line with respect to the constitutional language is that we want to know whether someone's subject to jurisdiction. And I don't really hear Ilan disagreeing too much with the idea that that means subject to authority. Now, he says, well, maybe it also requires that you have the ability to sue and so forth. And maybe that's true. But it seems to me that we don't have a rule that people who are here unlawfully are barred from our courts. And we certainly believe that people who are here unlawfully are subject to our laws. That is, they must obey our laws. And they're subject to our law enforcement in that we can take enforcement action against them and we can bring them into court. And it seems to me that subject to jurisdiction means under the authority for the reasons that I already said. And so I guess I don't find anything in most of what Alon says to be undermining that at all. Now, I do think there's a critical question about what's going on with the native tribes. And that brings me over then to one of Trent's points about we recognize that there are these exceptions, the native tribes, the invading armies and the diplomats and others in that that are similarly situated. I don't think it's a closed list, as you said. And I think what is common about all of them is that as to significant parts of their activity, the United States didn't claim authority, either lawmaking authority or law enforcement authority. So just as to the tribe, sure, we did have laws as to their interactions with Americans, but we didn't, by and large, have laws with respect to their internal affairs. And that's what the framers said took them outside of the jurisdiction and therefore outside of citizenship. Then similarly, the diplomats, I think we all agree, the reason that they are outside of jurisdiction is because, again, as a general matter, diplomats are not subject to the lawmaking and law execution authority of the United States because they have sovereign immunity or diplomatic immunity under international law. And then finally, as to the invading armies, or it's not just invading armies, also I think soldiers generally as instruments of the sovereign had immunities as recognized in Schooner Exchange. But as to the invading armies, They were also under international law, not subject to the local law of the sovereign. They were rather subject to the laws of war under international law. And so that again took them outside of the traditional jurisdiction or the territorial jurisdiction of the sovereign. They were subject to the laws of war and could be enforced against them by the territorial sovereign. But it's a different kind of jurisdiction from what you have for ordinary people. And so that's the commonality I see among those three categories. And there are other, I think, minor categories of people that would fit there. But the difference is that just ordinary people, even if they're not here lawfully, or even if they're only here temporarily, do not have these kind of immunities, do not have these kind of exceptions to law enforcement and law execution power of the territorial sovereign. And that's just what jurisdiction means. And that's the phrase that the framers chose to use, even if it doesn't align exactly with some of the things that were going on, I don't know, back in the Magna Carta time, whatever. I think we need to keep focused on what's going on in 1866. And then just on the last point that Trent made, which was actually his first point about Civil Rights Act. I do think Civil Rights Act is a little bit of a puzzle because it has this slightly different language, even though the framers of the 14th Amendment said that they were adopting the same rule as the Civil Rights Act. So what does that mean? So the first thing is, it can't mean when you say subject to the jurisdiction, not subject to a foreign power, that can't exclude all of the children of aliens born in the United States, because the framers of the 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause were also, as I mentioned in my opening, extremely clear that the children of Chinese immigrants in the United States would be citizens under the proposed language. So it can't be the case that simply being an alien or having your parents be aliens excludes you. So I think that you know, Wong Kim Ark, I think, was exactly right on that point. And to think otherwise would require going against the precise issue that was raised by the drafters and resolved by them and understood by them as being resolved. So I think that actually what the Civil Rights Act was trying to say, but it just didn't say it very artfully, and that's why they used the different language in the 14th Amendment, is that it was trying to pick up on this diplomat exception and say, people who are not subject to the foreign power in place of the United States, that is, that they're only under the authority of the foreign power and not under the authority of the United States. And those people were excluded from citizenship under the Civil Rights Act. And that's all it was trying to exclude. And again, when the Civil Rights Act was being debated, the drafters of the Civil Rights Act had the same exchange about whether it covered the Chinese immigrants or not. And they reached the same conclusion. And they said, this language, not subject to a foreign power, doesn't exclude the children of Chinese immigrants. That is, the children of Chinese immigrants would be citizens under the Civil Rights Act. So I think that trying to read that is to mean something broader, as Trent's suggesting, that the children of aliens are categorically excluded or generally excluded, that just doesn't align with the way the drafters were talking about their own language. So I think, again, what the Civil Rights Act was trying to do was find this exception for diplomats and other people who were not under U.S. authority, and that just wasn't artfully drafted. And then that's why they changed it around in the 14th Amendment to establish the rule if they wanted. So I don't know that I've covered everything that has been said, but I don't want to try to be exhaustive because I do want to let other people have their say. So I will stop there.
Let me get a quick response from Trent and from Ilan, and we'll see if there's time for a question or two after that. But I think the audience would prefer to hear from them than hear from me or hear from even other people who are in the audience. Trent.
Remember, I think it may have been Judge Randolph who had that line that says jurisdiction is a word of many, too many meanings, and it's been copied by others since then. And I think that's right. Like even now, jurisdiction, we don't know exactly what that word means. You go back 160 years, it becomes even more so. I want to briefly mention something that I think Professor Barnett alluded to, which is in the 14th Amendment, we have the subject to the jurisdiction language, but in the Equal Protection Clause, we have within the jurisdiction. That's the language there. Is there supposed to be a difference between the two? I think there probably was. I think within the jurisdiction is supposed to be a broader term, as getting to that idea of the state having an obligation to kind of protect the person, that if someone attacks the person, then of course you can go after the person who attacked them. They're not just considered like a non-entity, a non-person, whereas subject to the jurisdiction is supposed to be this term of art. I think on Professor Ramsey's argument about regulating internal affairs on the three exceptions, I think it's probably right that that is something that does explain those three exceptions, but I don't see how it stops there. I feel like it would continue to say the citizens and the children of citizens, the people who are born in other countries. So like the United States typically does not purport to have the authority to regulate the internal affairs of Mexico. And so by coming here, the Mexican citizens somehow give up that right. And it's funny when you read some of the documents, it was almost like the framers were a little bit scared of being perceived as arrogant. Like, we are going to award U.S. citizenship to people who don't want it because they're citizens of other countries or their children have other allegiances and that sort of thing. And wouldn't it be really arrogant for us to do that, just as it would be arrogant for us to purport to regulate what's going on in Mexico? So I think that is a possible through line. I think it doesn't satisfy the other requirement, which is that it stops there, but no further. I think the only other thing the only two things quickly is, I think Professor Ramsey is probably right. If I had my ideal rule, like what the correct answer is, I think it probably depends on how the parent's home country treats the children. So the mere fact that the parents are aliens does not necessarily mean the children could not get birthright citizenship. But by and large, almost every country would say those children, even though they're born in the U.S., are still loyal and nationals of the parents' home country. And I think in that case, they do have some sort of allegiance and affiliation with a foreign country, which would exclude them under the 14th Amendment. And the final thing I'll say is, if all this is about diplomats, I feel like it would be kind of much ado about nothing. I know diplomats maybe had a more important role back then than they do in today's modern world, but it seems like these are very important statutory and constitutional provisions. It just seems unusual to me that there would have been so much thought given and including an exception just to cover such a very narrow set of individuals. And so just from a practical sense, I wonder if that's true, then why were they so concerned about it?
Professor Werman.
Great. So I think I'll make three points, try to do it short. The first is this one, which, and again, in fairness to Professor Keith Whittington, he's not here with us, but I often hear this move about, well, maybe the common law was about protection, but we have to do jurisdiction. Okay, that's fine. We can talk about that, but that's a big admission, because the argument that is typically being made here is that this is a longstanding historic rule, hundreds and hundreds of years old. And I think the discussion between me and Professor Ramsey suggests that, well, maybe it's not. Maybe jurisdiction is doing something different. So if that's true, that's still a big concession, if you will, from the proponents of sort of a broad application of the rule. Now, shifting to jurisdiction, I do think they're connected in some way. And I think Professor Ramsey's response sort of helpfully distills the issue. What about POWs? So POWs are under the actual authority. They're not either subject to the sovereign's power and commands. But I think Professor Ramsey would agree that a POW in an American detention camp, a child born to a POW would not be a citizen, likely because the laws of war apply, which I think is just another way of saying, which is what Ramsey said, the municipal law doesn't apply. Some other law applies. But I think what we see from the War of 1812 cases is that if you come without protection, if you come without permission and are outside the protection of the sovereign, then the municipal law also doesn't apply to you, right? You don't get due process rights. You could be imprisoned like Charles Lockington. You might get habeas corpus to determine your status, but that's about it. You can't access the courts whether today they can or cannot, is an interesting point for the litigation, but I'm talking about the history. and how they treated it historically. And so in that sense, it's true that there's no like body of international law that applies to people who come here illegally, who are not enemy aliens, who are not, prisoners of war, but it doesn't change the fact that they are not subject to municipal jurisdiction, to its benefits, for example, some of its burdens, perhaps, but not to complete jurisdiction because they are not amenable to all of its benefits either. So it seems to me very similar to the POW situation. The final thing I'll say, which is going to be very summary of my position on temporary versus domiciled aliens. Professor Ramsey knows that my position on this is there are several respects in which temporary visitors may not be subject to that complete jurisdiction. So for example, in my paper, I show that the Louisiana military authorities concluded in the Civil War that they couldn't conscript children born in Louisiana to French parents unless the French parents had been domiciled. So they concluded that under the law of nations, they could not subject them to conscription. In this sense, they're not subject to the complete jurisdiction. I think we all know that a domiciled foreigner is subject to a general jurisdiction of a court because domicile determines a court's general jurisdiction. Temporary aliens might be temporarily subject to a court's jurisdiction, but once they leave, they're not subject to that general jurisdiction. That is a different scope of jurisdiction that applies to temporary versus permanent residents. And then in that treatise, the Wheaton Treatise that Professor Ramsey talked about, it says as a matter of international law, sovereigns don't apply their municipal law to temporary visitors with respect to personal status, like marriage, legitimacy, divorce, and things like that. Professor Ramsey has responded to me or will respond to me that it's a choice of law rule. And so what? Well, applying military law to POWs is a choice of law rule. Right? Applying diplomatic law to ambassadors is a choice of law rule. And so the point is, these are choice of law rules that preclude the sovereign from exercising its complete power because of some reason rooted in international law and the consent of in common practice among nations. So it seems to me that it would apply potentially to exclude temporary visitors and unlawfully present aliens, but probably not domiciled aliens, because I know of no exception to a complete jurisdiction for domiciled aliens.
Well, thanks. I think we have some time for some questions. I've spotted a couple of short ones. Some of them are really too long to read. One, I think, sort of critical of each side. The first one, I think, would be one posed to Professor Ramsey. And it also is reminiscent of some of the things that Ilan has just said. And here's the question from Rod Sullivan. Should someone born in the United States to non-citizens have a lifetime obligation to pay U.S. taxes, a lifetime obligation to serve in the U.S. military if drafted, a lifetime entitlement to Medicaid, and a lifetime right to vote?
I'm going to take that question as being whether they do under the 14th Amendment citizenship clause as originally understood, because whether they should or not, I take it as a question of policy. And as a matter of policy, I am inclined to be somewhat sympathetic to the question of whether they should or not. But we're not talking about policy here, and I'm not making policy. So I think you could certainly argue that they shouldn't. I think, as I said, under the original understanding, I think that is indeed what they were saying, is that you have this general rule that makes people citizens, if they're born here, subject to these small exceptions. And we can debate how broad the exceptions are, that was not a novel position being taken by the framers of the 14th Amendment, that people would get citizenship as a result of birth here. And again, it went back to the English law. It was commonly used in the 19th century in the United States. So it wasn't radical. Again, you can debate about the categories of the fringes, but the idea that just by being born in the United States, that you would have these access to citizenship rights, that there wasn't a novel idea. And so it doesn't strike me as absurd that the framers would have adopted that rule. And indeed, they talked about this with respect to Chinese immigrants, and they said, yeah, no, that is the rule we're adopting. So, yeah, I think that is the original meaning, whether it's a good idea or not is, above my pay grade.
All right. This is a question. Two people asked versions of this question, and I'll ask this to Professor Werman, and Trent can reply if he wants to as well. Doesn't Professor Werman's, this is from Anthony Hawks, doesn't Professor Werman's argument suggest that unlawful aliens aren't protected from the laws against murder, et cetera? How can that be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something Professor Whittington argues also in his paper. And I think I would say the following, which is you can be under the protection of law to some respect without being under the protection of the sovereign in the complete respect and in the sense of the 14th Amendment. So ambassadors, for example, they're understood not to have any local allegiance and not to be under the protection of the sovereign in the relevant sense for the 14th Amendment. But does anyone deny that they have the right under the law of nations to the protection of the law when in another sovereign's country? Because if this argument, you take it to its ultimate conclusion, we would be able to just kill ambassadors, but obviously because they're not under the protection of the law. But obviously that's not true. Congress actually passed laws early on providing protection of law to ambassadors. No one would say that therefore they're subject to the protection in the relevant sense and subject to our jurisdiction in the relevant sense, such that their children are would be birthright subjects at common law. And when you look at, you know, some of the sources do distinguish this, right? So the safe conduct passage that I read from Blackstone, I don't want to read too much into this. It's just one passage. He said during the continuance of a safe conduct, the foreigner is under the protection of the king and under the protection of the law. So like potentially there were two different ideas. Protection of the law is a subset of the sovereign's protection to which aliens may be entitled. It doesn't mean that they're under the protection in the relevant sense, at least of the common law.
Yeah, this issue did come up during the debates among the drafters of the 14th Amendment, where they say, we're talking about jurisdiction. What do we mean? Does this mean that you could just go up and commit crimes against these people and nothing can happen? They said, no, that's jurisdiction in a sense, but it's not the jurisdiction that we mean here. We mean a different kind of jurisdiction, kind of like a civic jurisdiction that entitles, you know, the right to vote and military service and that sort of thing. And so it's unfortunate that in their minds, these two concepts largely used the same or very similar terminology, but it was something that they viewed as distinct. I don't know that they had the full historic common law understanding that Professor Werman has provided, but they seem to conceptualize the same issue, that these are practically distinct, even though we're using similar terms.
And by the way,
go ahead. Yeah, go on.
Just one more point about what Trent just said. In the legislative history of the Civil Rights Act, they also explain why they said not subject to any foreign power. And they were asked, why don't you use the language of allegiance, which is the counterpart to protection? And Trumbull said something like, well, upon investigation, it was determined that even ambassadors have a kind of allegiance, or we owe them a kind of protection. And so, or at least foreigners, visitors. And so they were grappling with that possibility too, that if you use the language of allegiance and protection, that might cover ambassadors, it might not cover ambassadors, because they were to some degree subject to protection, but not necessarily in the relevant sense. So it's also in the debates of the Civil Rights Act.
So I have a concluding question for all the three participants, and that is this. I mean, the amendment was drafted in the context of African-American enslaved people who had just been emancipated and who were denied citizenship due to the Dred Scott case. And that was the same thing addressed in the Civil Rights Act of 1866 by statute. And there was a question of whether Dred Scott could be reversed by a statute rather than a constitutional amendment. How much, if anything, does that context figure into the original meaning of the clause? Because we've spent all our time talking about every other conceivable category, but not the category at which the amendment was actually addressed. Is that too narrow? Is that original intent? Is that original purpose? Is that original function? Is it relevant? And so I'd just be curious to get all the panelists' response to that before we wrap up. And so why don't we do Ilan first?
So I would say it's relevant in the following sense, that any theory of the amendment has to confer citizenship on the freed people, right? Because that was the whole objective. And if it doesn't, it's fatally flawed. I'll just say under my, you know, version of a complete jurisdiction, even if you just go back to the common law language, this is actually what they said in the debates, that they were under the protection of the United States. They didn't have an allegiance to any foreign government. They were not subjects to any foreign power. There is no sense in which they were not subject to the complete jurisdiction of the United States, whether under the language of the 14th Amendment or the common law. So it does the necessary, work. But I will say one other thing about this more conceptually. I mean, it would be astonishing. I mean, it's possible, okay, that through this use of language subject to the jurisdiction to clarify a point about the native tribes, the framers, who did not think about issues a little bit of temporary visitors, maybe they thought about, certainly they didn't think about illegal visitors. It's possible that through this tweak in language, they inadvertently constitutionalized a rule that went far beyond what was necessary to accomplish the result that they were intending to accomplish, namely citizenship for the freed people. It's possible, but if the language is liable to multiple interpretations and it's ambiguous, right? Isn't it tribal by its consequences, as James Madison once said? Isn't it relevant that they didn't think about this particular issue and it can be read to avoid application to those issues while still giving the core, solving the core problem of the citizenship of the freed people? So I would say those two points about the role of Dred Scott and granting citizenship to the freed people.
Professor Ramsey, what have you to say about this?
Well, I agree. Sure, I agree. It's relevant in the sense that clearly was what was foremost on their mind, was to grant citizenship to the freed slaves, and also, well, to blacks more generally as a result of the Dred Scott, overturning the Dred Scott opinion. And they could have said just that, that they were overturning Dred Scott and giving citizenship to people of African descent. But they didn't say that. They used the broader phrase jurisdiction. And I would have to say, contrary to my fellow panelists, I don't see any ambiguity in jurisdiction at all. There was a single meaning of jurisdiction, and it meant under authority. And so they used that. And then they were clearly understanding that their language was broader than simply focused on people of African descent, because they had this extended discussion of the people of Chinese descent, and they understood that their language would indeed encompass those people. And there were people at the time who objected to that on policy grounds, but there wasn't any dispute about the scope of the language. And so I think what you have is they used very broad language to accomplish, yes, a narrow objective with respect to overturning the Dred Scott case, but also to establish a broad rule. They understood that they were establishing a broad rule. And so I think it's the broad rule that we're left with.
Oh, and last word will go to Trent.
The only thing I'll add is that, again, you may notice the 14th Amendment uses slightly different words. So the birthright clause uses the verb are, A-R-E, whereas the subsequent clauses use it shall be. Maybe that's just unintentional. Maybe there's a meaning there, but there's an argument that's been made that the R is indicating that we are doing kind of a one-time fix, or at the very least, that's what we're most concerned about. These people are now citizens. And then the rest of the clauses are, okay, going forward, here's how things will be done. And so I think, again, maybe that's just the way that the words fit together nicely on a paper, but it could also be that there's, at the very least, an indication that this was primarily a one-time, like, present determination, as opposed to a much broader rule.
Well, thank you. Thank you to all our three panelists. I don't know if Matt comes back on to say goodbye to our audience. Go ahead, Matt.
Yes, thank you all. Thank you, Professor Barnett. Thank you to our speakers. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you as well, our audience, for listening and for the time and expertise of our experts. We always welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.